Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Liz Busby. I'm a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, and a Latter-day Saint. And with me today is my co-host, Carl.
Hello, everyone. My name is Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion and have written on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture.
And we have two guests with us today. Jacob, will you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm also a writer, a Mandalorian lover, so I'm excited for this conversation. I live up in Cache Valley. I'm a wannabe farmer, but the ground is still cursed where I live.
Awesome. And we also have with us today, Jared. Will you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm a Harvard graduate, aviator, avid scuba diver, all-around adventurer, and previously excommunicated and rebaptized LDS member of the church.
And as was mentioned, today we're going to be talking about The Mandalorian, a series in the Star Wars universe about a bounty hunter, which you can watch on Disney+. We'll be specifically focusing on Season 3, where the Mandalorian seeks redemption for breaking his religious vow to never remove his helmet, though I'm sure we'll also bring in details from Seasons 1 and 2. But first, we'll be doing our best book segment, where we each recommend one thing we're watching, reading, or listening to. My recommendation today is a book by Joe Walton called Lent. It's a very religious alternate history novel or a speculative fiction history novel. The main character is a monk in Renaissance Italy. He has the power to see and cast out demons, and so he's trying to protect Florence from demonic incursion by encouraging people to be righteous, and they build up this wall of prayer that protects the city of Florence, and the French invade, and there's trouble with the Pope. And then at the 1/3 mark, there is a big, big twist in the story, which I am not going to spoil for you, but it changes the nature of the narrative, becomes much more of a Groundhog's Day type speculative fiction book. I thought this book had a lot of really interesting religious questions about free will, the nature of the atonement and redemption, how we repent, kind of relevant to the Mandalorian discussion today. So I highly encourage you to read Lent by Joe Walton. Carl, what have you got to share with us today?
Aside from continuing the projects that I've mentioned before, getting back into The Simpsons, and now watching all of Bluey, because there's a lot of it. Something that I've picked up recently that I haven't finished yet because it just came out is Vengeance is Mine, which is the sequel to the Massacre at Mountain Meadows book published by Oxford University Press in like 2008. This is about the aftermath of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, also by Rick Turley and also with Barbara Jones Brown this time. And as I understand it, Rick and Barbara had to cut a substantial portion to get this down to size, but it is an analysis and a historical discussion of everything that happened after the Mountain Meadows Massacre. That first book from Oxford is one of the seminal academic books that I've ever read in my life, because it talked about how these were all relatively normal people who had a really bad weekend and committed atrocities and then were haunted by them for the rest of their life. And just the discussion of what does it take for a normal person to do something like this. One of the other books that along the same line that I've read is called Ordinary Men, which is about like a Polish group of Nazis who slowly over the course of World War II became like full-blown Nazis with regard to their Jewish neighbors. And both books are haunting because it just shows how normal people can end up doing really bad things. And so this book is a discussion of everything that happened afterwards, some of the conspiracies, the cover-up, some of the politics that is really interesting that I was unaware of, how sort of the Latter-day Saints were like, please prosecute these people, get this stuff going. And a lot of the federal officials were like, let's wait till next year after the election, and just the interesting dynamics like that coming into play. But it is a haunting book like the first one, and something that I think every Latter-day Saint should maybe don't have to read, but need to at least be aware of, because this is a part of our history that we should not forget. And so, Vengeance is Mine, The Mountain Meadows Massacre and Its Aftermath by Rick Turley and Barbara Jones Brown.
I'm excited to read this. It's a really sad and difficult part of our history, but so important for us to think about and talk about.
Fascinating.
Jacob, what have you got to recommend for us today?
Wow, you're both so high-minded.
I mentioned that I'm starting with The Simpsons, right? So don't take all of that as you will.
I want to make a plug for the Andy Griffith Show, all right? In two parts. Everything is so fast. And I've noticed when my boys watch some of the media today, even if it's just pretty innocuous, their brains are just like fired up and they act like little jerks afterwards. So we've been experimenting, showing them these old Andy Griffith episodes, and they're slow and the camera's just on a conversation between Opie and Andy, and they watch it. Our kids are not been so corrupted that they can't actually watch it. My younger brother grew up on Bourne Identity, and he literally cannot watch a black and white movie anymore. His brain just does not do it. So we're intentionally trying to like give our boys a diet of slow things too, so that they can do it. Because I've sometimes wondered if we expose our kiddos to all this stuff and then say, read this scripture. And they're like, huh? My brain can't even compute this or sit and listen to this conference. So one other note on Andy Griffith, Barney, who was like the funny deputy, he grew up with an abusive father who actually chased him around with a knife. So Barney grew up with this nervous disposition that ends up being one of his great comedic gifts because he had gone through such trauma as a kid and he had like this nervous disposition. So interesting how some of the most painful stuff we pass through can end up being gifts later on. So there you go.
Love it. It's always good to build up our muscles for consuming art from older periods.
Yeah, I regret not getting my kids started on Mr. Rogers. The stuff that they do watch is not as bad as something like SpongeBob, where there's like a cut every half second, because Mr. Rogers will walk in and sing his song and talk to you and feed his fish and take his jacket off. It's like a 5 to 10 minute long Steadicam shot. Like, that just is not something that happens anymore. Yeah. So a fair and interesting point, and maybe one I'll try out with my kids someday. The Andy Griffith Show, who knew?
I've been even thinking about trying to implement this with books, because I read a C.S. Lewis quote that said, you should read at least one old book for every 3 new books. Because even though there are different historical attitudes that we believe are wrong in the past, at least they're making different mistakes than the mistakes that we're making today. And by aggregating different mistakes from different eras, we can correct for some of our biases in the modern day.
Boy, I have a hard time with that in books. After finishing the Harry Potter series with my boys, my mom wanted me to read a classic book to my boys, but after 3-headed monsters every chapter, it's hard to go to The Little Prince sitting and talking about a flower. It tests me as much as my boys.
I feel you there. I'm currently reading The Wind in the Willows to my 2 youngest, and we've been working on it since September, so we're still working on it. It's pretty tough, but when you get to the funny parts and they get it, that's nice. And it's definitely more difficult language and just different expectations for what children's literature was back then. Jared, what have you got to recommend to us?
So this morning I'm recommending Ted Lasso. It's on Apple Plus if you have Apple TV. The 3rd season just ended and it is the end of the story arc. It's a 3-season story arc. That's it. I loved it because the main theme of the arc is not judging people by their weakest moment, but embracing their potential in second chances. And so I thought that was apropos for our conversation this morning.
I still need to finish the last 2 episodes of season 3. So you recommend finishing it. I was a little disappointed by some of those episodes in the middle there. I was like, questionable.
No, you'll be fine.
Okay. I will not judge Ted Lasso by its weakest episode.
That's right. It will not disappoint you.
We will have links to all these recommendations on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. Buying through these links helps support our podcast so we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and beautiful in pop culture. And now we'll move on to our main discussion of The Mandalorian. I am excited to discuss this today. Carl, you've been recommending this a couple times on the podcast, and I know you're probably a bigger Star Wars fan than I am. I've seen them all, and I am always excited to watch new Star Wars, but I'm not a Star Wars fan in the way I'm a Star Trek fan. So tell me about your reaction to season 3 of The Mandalorian, Carl.
So I gotta lay a little bit of background for the reasons I really enjoyed season 3 of The Mandalorian as much as I did, especially preparing for this podcast and going back and rewatching parts of it and making sure I remember all the arcs correctly and the lines and some of the things like that. One of the things I do not like about Star Wars as a whole is how inconsistent it has been in its approach to religion. The original trilogy feels to me very Christian, very monotheist, almost Manichaean, where there's like the light side and the dark side, anger, fear, and aggression. The dark side are they. Once you start down the dark path forever, it will dominate your destiny, consume you at will, as it did Obi-Wan's apprentice. But we never really understood from that trilogy what the light side was really about. And then we get the prequel trilogy, and it shifts from being monotheistic to more Buddhist. Oh no, don't have any emotions. Anything of that nature is bad. We don't want you to care about your mother who's enslaved, or the woman that you love, we just want you to be like a celibate sort of cross between a Christian monk and a Far Eastern monk with your martial arts skills. And I didn't think those matched up very well, and also gave a terrible reason for Anakin to turn to the dark side. He wants to save his wife from dying in childbirth. That seems like a noble cause to me, as someone whose wife is about to have a baby next week. And then the sequel trilogy turned into spiritual but not religious, and I did not care for either the prequel trilogy or the sequel trilogy for a variety of reasons, but because I'm not Buddhist and because I'm certainly not spiritual, but not religious. And I just did not like those approaches. So to see season 3 of The Mandalorian really embrace religion and ritual and creeds and all this sort of stuff, religious clothing and symbolism, was just, really enjoyed it and felt like, oh, this is a moment where they're taking religion consistently seriously, both consistent and serious. And I really dug the arc of both our main character, who needs to be redeemed for having apostatized, and arc of Bo-Katan, because I thought hers was actually the more interesting arc. Which is actually a complaint I have about the whole Mandalorian series, is it seems like their most interesting characters are often not the main character. So that's, anyway, just a storytelling critique. But I'll stop talking now. I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was good to see them taking the trappings of religion very seriously. And previous iterations of Star Wars have not, or at least have not been consistent about what that means.
Jared or Jacob, either of you want to jump in? What are your general impressions?
Oh, I agree with Caro. My dad texted me early in the season. He said, wow, the symbolism is so interesting of the Mandalorian. Din needs to bathe in the living waters to be redeemed and forgiven so he can become a Mandalorian again. And I responded to my dad, yeah, just wait. Yeah, they're setting up the season, but just wait. They'll poke fun at this by the end of the season. I was really surprised to watch the season progress and have even more where Din says the creed teaches us of redemption. And he goes and bathes in living waters and he says, I swear on my name and the name of the ancestors that I shall walk the way of the Mandalore. And the words of the creed shall be forever forged in my heart. This is the way. Anyway, they didn't do what I thought they did. I just assumed all Hollywood writers would drift entropy-wise towards where Star Wars drifted, to the point that the Jedi Temple burns down and the texts burn down.
And it's like good riddance, like, this is good, let's burn down all the religious tradition.
Exactly. And Luke Skywalker, who is the epitome of hope and like fighting for truth, ends up being this embittered old man, to the point that the guy who plays Luke Skywalker talks about having anxiety at what they did to his character and hating what Star Wars did to his character. Anyway, a lot of us felt the same way. So the contrast between The Mandalorian and previous episodes of Star Wars was quite stark.
Although, point of order, when Yoda says to Luke, there's nothing in those books that the woman Rey does not already possess, there's a double pun going on there because she actually has the texts. Those didn't burn down. And I hear rumors they're going to do another little sequel series of movies where she rebuilds the Jedi Order, which should have been Luke's deal, but whatever. I'll just mind canon it that this is what Luke would have done in the correct timeline. But she has those texts, and I hope that they do something a little more seriously than just, oh, it's just a bunch of old books that aren't page turners.
Yeah, amen. But of course, it was more than just their treatment of religion. It was the fact that, as Mark Hamill says later on, that's not my Luke Skywalker. Jedis don't give up. If Luke had a problem, he would take a year and regroup. If he made a mistake, he would try and right that wrong. And for us, we would see that as also part of the gospel, right? The gospel is relentless growth and trying again and getting up again. And that goes away in Star Wars. That's part of the hero arc that we love.
Part of that is because George Lucas goes away in Star Wars. George Lucas, he wrote Star Wars to be, yeah, you can be part of the light side and think you're doing good, but you're not doing good. That's the whole riff, is that you're a Jedi and you're supposed to be a peacekeeper and you engage in a war. But that's not what peacekeepers do. Peacekeepers prevent wars. They don't win wars, or they keep the peace. And that's the whole point, is there's good and bad in the galaxy. And when you think you're on the good side, sometimes you don't realize that what you think is good is not as good as you thought. And that disappears because George Lucas is not part of the sequels. He's not part of episodes 7, 8, and 9. And so that disappears. And then also a lot of the canon, like all of Star Wars is Anakin's story. And in 7, 8, and 9, there's this transition to now it's Palpatine's story, and Rey is now Palpatine's granddaughter. And that really messes up the whole consistency of it, which is exactly Carl's point, right? It becomes inconsistent.
I'd say I did a line from the novelization of episode 3, where Yoda is figuring out that he can't beat Palpatine in their lightsaber fight because he is fighting a war against the darkness. And how do you win a war against the darkness when war is one of the tools of darkness?
There you go.
Yeah, it's a great line. So that ties in really well to when Luke gives up at the end of episode 6. He throws his lightsaber away and says, no, I'm not going to fight you because I'm a Jedi. That is a great little theme that they have running throughout. As inconsistent as I think it goes from sort of monotheism to Buddhism, that was a theme that I thought was consistent throughout, and I liked it. But yeah, Luke gives up and just, I'm going to go live in this temple and die off. The Jedi are going to go with me. And Jin is, no, I'm going to go down to the cursed planet and bathe in the waters of the mines of Mandalore because I want to be redeemed. I'm not going to give up. Let's go. Let's do this thing. And I think there's a reason we like this character a lot more than what they did to poor Luke Skywalker.
And I think you'll see a lot of that consistency come back, Carl, with Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni now creating The Mandalorian, bringing back the consistency of Star Wars. They're really, Dave Filoni did all of Clone Wars, did all of Rebels. You see a lot of Clone Wars and Rebels tied into season 3 of The Mandalorian. It's there. It's all there. And so he's bringing that consistency that George Lucas had back that was lost in Hollywood in episodes 7, 8, 9. So as we jump into Mandalorian and the story arcs and the merging of the stories across the galaxy, we're starting to see that consistency come back under Dave Filoni, which is why the piece of religion is so heavy now, right? It's not burn it down, throw it away, we don't need it. It is like, this is a major part of the beliefs of these people, right? Matter of fact, the episode, The Believer in season 2, he talks about Alderaan believed one thing, Mandalore believed another thing, yet they don't exist anymore. We all come together and they're the same. And so I think we see more of that consistency in The Mandalorian coming back.
Do we know if Dave Filoni is religious? I know that Jon Favreau is Jewish, or at least was raised Jewish. I don't know if he's practicing anymore, but I know he did have his bar mitzvah at some point as an adult, I believe. So that is interesting to me, because I think the parallel to the various sects of The Mandalorian are Reform Judaism versus Conservative Judaism versus Orthodox Judaism. It's a lot of parallels there. I don't know. Do we know if Dave Filoni is religious? Or
from the articles I read, there are several articles in Jewish media talking about how Mandalorians are space Jews, and it's great. But they consistently describe him as a Hebrew school dropout. So it seems like he partially completed a Jewish education, but didn't finish it or continue along that track. But he does have a good grounding in Jewish beliefs and a little more deep than just being culturally Jewish, say.
That's Jon Favreau. I'm asking about Dave Filoni, who's becoming more the showrunner for all of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And so that'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. I'm glad they're taking it seriously, though.
Yeah, I did not expect the first half of the season, I was like, oh, we're just continuing the story of the Mandalorian. And then in the last four episodes or so, we start connecting and I'm like, oh, this is trying to make the sequel trilogy make sense. Like, we're seeing where the First Order came from and why the heck Palpatine is suddenly back. Like, we're starting to see these kind of things that make the universe make sense. And I think that was something that was definitely missing for me in the sequel trilogy was, how does this connect? How does this make sense at all? And the fact that they're trying to establish that consistency, which is so important in the speculative fiction genre, like things have to make sense. World building is super important, not just, we need something cool on screen. Let's make something up. And don't worry about consistency. So I really enjoyed kind of the connections that they were starting to build. It started to redeem those movies for me. Yeah, but moving on to talk about the different sects of the Mandalorians, I was definitely seeing a ton of religious significance between these two sects. And I was surprised and delighted with kind of how we resolved this conflict. Well, rather didn't resolve this conflict between the Orthodox Mandalorians who believe you need to never remove your helmet in front of another person and the more reformed Mandalorians who are like, eh, we wear it sometimes, no big deal. I was worried they were going to go this route that like the Orthodox ones realized they were wrong. They were cults, as they said in season two. They're like, oh, you guys are that weird cult of Mandalorians. I was worried we were going to go that route, but they choose not to go that route. Obviously, like as a conservative religious person, my preferred route would have been, oh, they all realize that this is the way and all the reformed ones start wearing their helmets all the time. But I think they've found a good third way to say that we can both exist and we can share commonalities and share a planet and not tear ourselves apart. There's a good commentary at the end where they're saying Mandalore did get wiped out by the Empire, but it was struggling before because of these civil wars between factions of the same group, which it happens. And it tore apart Europe for a long time, different factions of Christianity fighting over things that nowadays people think are a joke. Why would we fight over transubstantiation and whether the Catholic Church has the priesthood or whether the priesthood matters? What's the big deal? Why are we killing each other over these things? And yet this is a thing that happens. Religious interfighting is sometimes more dangerous than fighting between different religions. So I liked that statement of resolution that we see you Orthodox Mandalorians, we can live with you. And we see you Reformed Mandalorians, we still think that you're wrong, but we can live together. We can come together for the things that we believe in and the things that we share. And we can share a planet without hating each other.
Beautiful. Here's the direct quote, Liz. Mandalore has always been too powerful for any enemy to defeat. It is always our own division that destroys us. I agree that the old sort of religious wars in Europe seem quaint to us, but Atlantic journalist Helen Lewis, she's a lapsed Catholic and now she's an atheist. She argues that transubstantiation for Catholics is the same as social justice folks saying a trans man is a man. It has a rationality to them that others don't understand. And if we take an interfaith frame around even these sociopolitical differences, then the interfaith warfare is just as fierce in America as it ever was in Europe. Like, we're fighting hard. So I do think that was a beautiful way to bring it together. Because it's fair to say that every religious tradition, whether it's the social justice religion or Latter-day Saint, there are things about our faith that people just don't get. They don't get why we love temples and symbolism and ritual. And some of us look at social justice symbolism and they're like, ah, we scratch our head a little bit too. But if we could bring that interfaith frame around it and just say, yeah, there's lots of different religious traditions and we don't always understand it or appreciate, but there are some things we can appreciate about their tradition.
It's a concept that's called holy envy that is one that I think we all ought to use more in our religious lives. The idea is you look at a different tradition, whether that is a different Christian tradition for us Latter-day Saints, or even something like Buddhism, or even atheism, or social justice, like all these other people who have very different beliefs, and look at them and you say, oh, I wish we had that. Like when you look at something else another church has, and you say, I wish we had a liturgical calendar. That's something that Roman Catholics do and High Church Protestants do that we Latter-day Saints do not do. And I really wish that we Latter-day Saints did. We have Come Follow Me now as sort of a version of a liturgical calendar. But it is something that I think they handled really well in this season of The Mandalorian. I really like that at the end of this season, the sort of moment that brings them all together is the relighting of the forge. Like, again, talking about space Jews, I thought that was something we Latter-day Saints had owned before, but nope, Mandalorians got it now. More than a few hints of relighting and rededicating the temple that they celebrate at Hanukkah. Like, It was just really good to see them come together around this sort of moment of something that is meaningful both to, I love that we're using the terms Reform and Orthodox Mandalorians, that is very meaningful to both of them, regardless of their approach to these various aspects of the creed and the way. We all want there to be a forge on Mandalore where we can make our armor. And so we can all come together for this thing. It's kind of like doing an ecumenical service for Easter sunrise or something with everybody who believes that Jesus Christ rose from the dead on the third day. Let's all get together and celebrate that. We can get back to our internecine warfare tomorrow.
But I think I want to push back on the holy envy thing, because sometimes it's easier to have holy envy for people who are wholly outside your tradition. It's easy for me to look at Judaism and be like, cool, if I wasn't a Latter-day Saint, I would totally be Jewish. That would be awesome. But it's much harder when the two groups are nominally part of the same group and acting differently. And that's why this Catholic-Protestant warfare in Europe was so hard, is because they were both Christian. And I think often within the Latter-day Saint tradition, when we see someone in our ward who practices different than we do, who makes different choices, it's so hard to be accepting in the same way that we can be accepting of someone who's outside our tradition much more easily. When you see someone who makes different modesty choices than you do, or whose family makes different choices about the Sabbath than you do, or very modern one and relevant to the Mandalorian, chooses to wear their garments differently than you do, and you have strong beliefs that they are wrong, doctrinally wrong about this thing, it is extremely hard to be accepting and kind towards that person, whether you're on the more Reform side or the more Orthodox side. It's difficult. I felt like this was a very rare thing to see portrayed in media, that we can recognize that we don't agree on these issues and that they do matter to us. They're not unimportant, and yet continue on, not have to come to a conclusion immediately.
Well said, Liz. I think that's a part of the holy envy thing that is important to underscore, that it's not some promiscuous, hey, the differences don't matter, let's just appreciate each other. Like, we can still disagree vociferously within our tradition and with others about certain matters. But if I could riff a little bit more off your comments, Carl, I've noticed in marriage how easy it is to be threatened by differences in your marriage. If your spouse has a strength that you don't have, it's so easy to be threatened by that rather than say, hey, how cool that you got this strength that I don't have. And I think it's a beautiful way to lead out in all of our relationships, marriage and beyond, to see, what can I see about my evangelical friends that I just love, and my Buddhist friends, and my liberal Latter-day Saint. One thing I love about all my liberal friends is they ask questions about freaking everything. My conservative friends go to the doctor, and the doctor says something, and they're like, yes, sir, I'll do whatever. My liberal friends go to the doctor, and if they hear something they don't like, they're like, what the heck? I'm going to go get a second opinion. Like, they question in a way that's really valuable. So, hurrah for holy envy.
I like your thoughts on that, and holy envy and strength in your difference. I wanted to hit briefly on who I think is the most interesting character this season, which is not the Mandalorian. I think it is Bo-Katan. Because you think about it, she is there like the monarch in exile, basically. She doesn't have the Darksaber, so nobody will listen to her. And then this weird little friend of hers, who's this religious zealot, shows up and says, no, I'm going to go down to the cursed planet that is poisoned and maybe die because I want to redeem myself. And she's like, okay, I guess I'll help you out, and does. But then she ends up diving in to save him, and so she herself is baptized. While she's down there, she has a vision. Like, that's what we would call this religiously, where she sees the mythosaur, and she's like, I thought those were not, I didn't think those were real. I thought that was a myth. And then she returns Din to his cult, that's what she calls it. But then they're like, no, yeah, absolutely, you're one of us. Welcome, this is the way. She's like, oh, I guess I just joined this religious convent. That's cool. And then the priest of this convent, the armorer, when she says, I saw a mythosaur and I want this to be part of my armor and sort of one of the motifs that I have. And the armorer, who serves as the priest for these group of people, basically says, I think it's time for a new age of our people to begin, and you will be the prophet who leads us to the promised land, basically. And then she's able to unite the disparate factions of her people and bring them back to their homeland, where they redeem it against the oppressors and relight the forge at the end. I'm like, there's so much Jewish symbolism going on here. It's fantastic.
I read that the fragment of green stone that Din brings her back from the planet, the writing on it is in, of course, a made-up Mandalorian language, but somebody translated it, and it's Exodus.
Really?
Like they went that detailed on it. It's an Exodus one about the people being exiled and returning to the land. So I think 100% intentional.
Right? Seriously. But it's interesting to me that the person who can redeem and reunite these two together is basically like a mystic, a religious prophet, someone who has had this experience with the mythosaur and can walk in both worlds, as the armorer says, and even gives her permission to take her helmet off so that she can reunite the Orthodox and the Reform Mandalorians together, which is interesting. I liked, Liz, a comment that you made in the show notes talking about how if we'd been really serious about this, so we have Bo-Katan who can do both, but it would have been interesting to see some from each of these groups become the other, like some of the Reformer, like, no, I'm going to put my helmet on and go bathe in the waters, and then I'm not going to take it off again. And maybe some of the Orthodox are like, maybe I don't need to wear my helmet all the time, and I can go join these guys and still be a Mandalorian, and that would be interesting to see some crossover like that. But there is such obvious religious symbolism going on with Din being redeemed and being baptized, basically, in the waters. But all the stuff that happens to Bo-Katan is setting her up as a prophet figure, a messiah, a Moses figure, which is why I was really mad that they smashed the Darksaber. Because I was like, oh, why are you taking away like the one religious icon that they all agree on? I guess maybe the forge at Mandalore, like the Great Forge, is the other one. And they do restart it and redeem that together. But they crushed the Darksaber, and that felt to me like a completely burn it all down, we don't need those texts or Jedi temples moment to me. And I was like, oh, don't do that. Because the Darksaber is awesome. But I don't know. Maybe they'll bring it back later on, even though it's buried under rubble at the moment.
That's the thing with Dave Filoni. If you don't see the character die or don't see the item destroyed, it's always game.
Fair enough.
I do think it's interesting that they have this physical emblem of the Darksaber. I almost read it, since at that point I was reading this show very Jewish, I was like, I almost read it as like the Ark of the Covenant being lost. And we're going to lose that, but we're still united and we've still got beliefs together, even though we've lost this important thing. I did find it interesting the relationship between the physical and the spiritual in this show. Like you were saying, a lot of shows nowadays are very spiritual but not religious, and so there's not a lot of physical manifestations of what you believe. But here in The Mandalorian, we've got baptism in waters in a certain place. This physically matters. And I found very interesting the line that Bo-Katan says to him before she has her vision of the mythosaur. She says, oh, there's nothing magic about the mines. It's just water. Why does this matter? And his reply to her is, without our traditions to link our scattered people, what are we? That these traditions matter and that the physical forms of ordinances can change over time, but that we have them at all matters. Like, we believe that the temple is important and the form of the temple has changed over time, even in our modern time and certainly from ancient times to now, but that we have a ritual, it matters.
I was listening to one of my political podcasts, and one of the women there, who is Jewish, but I'm pretty sure she is Reform Jewish and might not even believe in God or anything else like that, just at one point she says, no, I'm pretty sure that's a ritual we're not going to give up. Passover's a thing. It's been a thing for 4,000 years. That's not going to change. And I loved just her approach to it. I forget the context, but just the idea that there was this thing that they were not going to change. We are set. Here it is. And we've been doing this for thousands of years. And we will continue to do it for thousands of years because this is the way. And that, I thought, was an interesting comment of her to say, no, pretty sure we're not going to give that up at this point.
And maybe one reason this is so refreshing is so much else in American culture feels like it's dissolving tradition. Anything that's traditional and ritualistic. Why do we need chastity? Why do you need marriage? Why do you need a sacred ritual like the sacrament? And to have anything in popular culture be more affirming is refreshing. I want to hear more from you, Jared, your background, your experience.
It's interesting to have these conversations because you look at the Jewish context, right? And everything we've talked about of the symbolism of the Jewish culture and traditions. And then we have our own culture and traditions. And we want to hold on to those so fiercely. But I think if we step, and this is what I did watching season 2 and season 3, you step back and you say, what's the bigger picture here? What's the pattern? So how can I connect those dots? And the Exodus and the tribulation and the return, it's all teaching us the plan of redemption. And that's what we're talking about is redemption. It's teaching us the plan of redemption in patterns. And so if you take that 36,000 foot view of this, you can see that Din Djarin is that one soul who works to redeem himself, right? He's going after it. He's going through the repentance process, as it were. And if you look back at it, his sin was he broke a rule, but he didn't break a principle of the gospel, right? If you look at it in that mindset, he didn't break a principle of the gospel. He did what he had to do in order to maintain his honor, in order to maintain his obligation. He did what he had to do. So he broke a rule. And what he did is break that tradition. He just broke a rule of the tradition. And if you separate the gospel from the doctrine, from the cultures and tradition of any religion, or LDS included, there are a lot of times where you can break a rule and feel like you're getting punished. And there was a comment I liked, excommunication isn't a punishment, and Din Djarin isn't seeing it as that. He's like going after it. He's going after the repentance process. And he can't do it alone. He can't do it by himself. He has to have someone help him. Someone gets in the water with him. And the person who got in the water with me is Carl. Carl rebaptized me, right? Carl's the one who did that with me. So I can see myself and Din Djarin and Carl and playing that role. And you, two of you have to get in the water. But what happens after that? After that, they tell you, okay, you've done this. Go and teach others. Go and help others. How did you battle your demons? How did you overcome your shortcomings, your weaknesses? Go and teach others that. And that's what they do, right? And in the big picture, you almost get, yeah, it's 12 tribes. Let's call it the 12 tribes of Israel. It's one people though, right? It's different tribes of Mandalorian, but it's one people. It's different religions, different churches, but it's the same family. It's the same eternal family. And so once you receive that redemption yourself, you have to work on saving the family. And I think that's the bigger picture is now it's not just about this church or that church. Mine's true, yours isn't. That's a tradition we hold on to. Mine's true, yours isn't. And it becomes us versus them. But you have to let go of that and look at the family as a whole and say, okay, now how do we do this together? And it's not like I'm going to convert you to this or I'm going to convert to that. That's why I like I can take off my helmet and I can keep my helmet on and we can work together at this. It becomes that eternal family perspective of how do we all get redeemed? Because that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah. And we see that Din's redemption is what kind of motivates Bo-Katan, who she has given up. when he first goes to talk to her about Mandalore and stuff, she's like, forget it. I failed at this redemption. I failed at everything. I give up. And we find out in the later episodes that she actually did surrender to the Empire in an attempt to save her people. And that totally failed. She got backstabbed. So she feels guilty for the whole destruction of Mandalore. And she's given up. And because Din pursued his redemption, she was inspired to not give up, to pursue and continue with the quest that she had. And she does it in a different way than him. She doesn't become the more orthodox Mandalorian, but she does benefit from his redemption in a way that redeems her as well. And then we find these people on the planet of Mandalore who've been surviving there for a long time, and they feel like they failed and they get redeemed. And so there's this upward spiral of one person making that choice to come back brings back all these other people, and this positive spiritual spiral that we can be in when we bring others with us as we return, as we try to be better.
As we return, right? Look at the stories that Jesus told, right? The prodigal son goes out, comes back as redeemed, but it comes back and redeems both himself and the brother, yeah. Right? As a family. You look at the sheep. Why do you leave the 99 to save the one? Because leaving to save the one saves the 99, right? The 99 see that and go, I trust that if that's ever me, you'll come after me too. And then the one comes back and says, hey guys, that was awful. Let's stick together. Every parable, every scripture it's about saving. You got to be the first one. But then the big picture is we all got to get home. All of us.
Yeah. No. Although, point of order, Jared, it was President Baird that baptized you. I was there in the confirmation circle.
Was it Baird? Was it James? I thought you...
No, it was James.
Hey, take the credit.
Yeah, take the credit.
I would, except that I don't want to take the credit away from President Baird, who, God rest his soul, is heavily influential. But I was there at the confirmation.
I remember you being a big part of it. I remember you being like... When I think about it, you're always the face that comes to mind.
That means a lot to me. Thank you. I remember President Baird talking to me about the disciplinary council to readmit you to the church, and how in your discussion of everything that had happened, my being the Elders Quorum president at the time had been very useful. And I'm glad to have played a part in that, but I'm just certain it wasn't that particular part.
It was a big part. I'll tell you that. It was a big part.
What was the term you used, Liz? Upward spiral? I'm happy to have played a part in that in your life, Jared, because you were a good brother to me, and I'm glad to know that I was for you as well. Helping each other get back to redeem all of us. This is the way.
This is the way.
Yeah. This is the work and the glory, right?
Yeah.
Jared, what you said about redemption is the most important part of this conversation. Can you elaborate just even a teeny bit more in case I want that to be underscored more than anything else, the redemptive narrative you were bringing out?
I have something we can maybe lead in with. I think it's interesting, like Jared said earlier, the show portrays being excommunicated from a church as a positive thing. I think typically in modern media, it would be, oh, this person got kicked out of a church. That church is judgmental and wrong. Not, oh, how can I bring myself into alignment again with this institution that I value? And so it was refreshing seeing that perspective portrayed, which is not one that we see. It's mostly condemning institutions for condemning people rather than saying this is a necessary part of maintaining our community and helping people be good people as part of that community.
Yeah, anybody who's ever been excommunicated and has come back, and I've met a few because I'm open with my story. The one thing we all have in common is we realize it's not punishment. God isn't punishing you. He's showing you something about yourself. He's teaching you something about yourself. Yeah, we can look at it as if the institution is judgmental, but through that process, you really have to learn your place, not in the church, but in the gospel. Right? And the gospel itself. And the gospel is transcendent of any institution or organization. The gospel is for everybody. We're all his children, right? And if you think big enough, the gospel is for everyone who's been born on earth, but the gospel is also for the third part that didn't get born on earth. It's for everybody. And so you really start to feel your place
in that, in the role of the plan of salvation and what that means, both as an individual and as a family.
Mm. That's awesome.
And it wasn't a punishment. It was truly like, let me teach you about you. Let me teach you about you and where you fit in the family and my plan, because you didn't understand it before.
Yeah, in many ways, like this ritual that is available as part of the way, they said the way speaks of redemption. The fact that you make that a part of the tradition, that there is a way to get kicked out, there's also a way to come back. I think that's an important distinction, that it's not just, oh, you broke this rule, and our two options would be either the rule didn't really matter and so you just keep doing what you're doing, or you've broken the rule and so now you're gone forever. Neither of those are great options. So it is nice to have that option of redemption that's built in, that feels very true.
Yes. It's interesting you say that, Liz. So I went to the temple with my wife just last week, and there's been a lot of changes. And one of the changes that absolutely just struck my heart and it just stood out to me is when they talk about Lucifer in the premortal existence and they talk to him again in the Garden of Eden, you think, oh, he's the worst of the worst and absolutely the worst. And Satan's just, but God is speaking to him face to face as a father speaks to his son face to face. And he uses the words cast down. Cast Lucifer down, but he never uses the words cast out. And for someone like me who thought I'm being cast out, excommunicated, no, never cast out. Not even the worst of the worst is cast out. You might be taken down a notch, you might be humbled, but you're never cast out. You're never thrown away.
That is a beautiful insight. Thank you. Yeah.
And your witness, Jared, that the whole thing reflects love is also powerful. I agree with Liz that this idea of excommunication feels so judgy. But even just the existence of a standard outside of ourselves that we're supposed to reach towards is being cast as shaming anything that is expected of us to yield towards. It's, no, how you are exactly as you are is perfect. So just the idea that that something outside of ourselves, God or authority or scripture or the way, can be loving and good and a blessing is, again, so rare in pop culture. I also wanted to give a little plug that as a father of young boys, it's so hard to find stuff in pop culture that we can watch together and enjoy. Partly because they throw in a little innuendo, a little profanity, or a little graphic violence that is just farther than, you know, shocks my boys. And Mandalorian doesn't have any of that, really.
And it's got so many good, positive, like, mentor-foundling, father-son relationships where they're doing very manly fighting things. We're all going to spar against each other and determine who wins. And it feels like a very positive masculine culture where we're teaching you skills by letting you compete and exercise your competitiveness, but it's within a structure, within an order, within honor and respect of each other. I really appreciate that for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's difficult for any show, even in pop culture right now, it's difficult to mimic yourself after any religious tradition and also not teach the plan of redemption, right? Because the entirety of Judaism teaches that, and the entirety of other religions teach the same thing. And so as this show incorporates and follows, mimics the Jewish culture and the Jewish traditions and all the rites and rituals and baptism and redemption, it's hard not to, I'm sure they did not intend to, but it's hard not to teach the plan of redemption if you're mimicking what teaches the plan of redemption.
So I have two questions really quick, just on a theological point. Jared, do you believe that it is possible for Satan and the sons of perdition to return to the way, or have they chosen their path? In 10 seconds or less, like, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this.
Let's solve this theological problem right here, right now. You got 2 minutes.
After having gone through the temple and having that hit me so hard, that is the ultimate, leaving the 99 and going after the one. It is the absolute ultimate leaving the 99 and going after the other one. And there's only one person who can do that, and he will never give up. He will never stop trying. Mm. And so I think there is a way to join the way.
Huh. That is interesting.
There are definitely branches of Christianity and even in our own church who have had this opinion. So it's one of those speculative fringe doctrines that we can have fun speculating about, and which side you believe is not super important to your salvation. So it's fun.
You can all read that chapter in my dissertation if you'd like to get the really nitty-gritty version of it.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
And the other was just a comment. I liked, Liz, the way you said how so much of pop culture, when there is some form of excommunication, we just look askance at the institutions for being judgy, for having rules and regulations. And part of me just wants to point out, like, that is part of what it means to be an institution. If you're going to join the Lions Club, you have to adhere to the charter of what the Lions Club is. Like, and that's just, it feels like too often we just lose that. And so it's good, resonating with what you said as well, Jacob, that The Mandalorian seems to be doing a really good job of showing the balance that can be struck in a healthy way between an individual's choices and yet the rules and regulations of a tradition or a sect or a religion or whatever label we want to call his particular group of Mandalorians. Although I do really like the term Orthodox Mandalorian and Reform Mandalorians.
Well, and this has reminded me of Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone. Like, one of the consequences of this modern impulse to dismantle institutions and be free and be spiritual, not religious, is that we have this loss of institutions, even like bowling leagues. Nobody anymore wants to be committed to regularly show up on Thursday at the bowling alley. We want to be able to be spontaneous, and I don't want to be obligated to you to show up. And that has had negative effects on our society. Like, we have gone too far in dismantling institutions. Institutions are a positive force in human history and in human life. We need those stabilizing institutions where something happens on a regular basis and where there are rules and we are part of something. And that brings positive things to our psychology and to our minds that cannot exist without some kind of institution with rules.
Amen to that. Yeah. And that's intuitive to those who value authority and loyalty, which are like moral intuitions of conservatives. For my progressive friends who are more of the care and fairness, like John Heitz.
The righteous mind. Yes. Pick it up.
You're absolutely right that all institutions have this, but it's been interesting to watch some institutions pretend like they don't have to have any loyalty or authority. One progressive organization I was friends with in college, they spent months and months and months because they didn't want anyone to be the leader. No leaders. And so they spent months just trying to find like this consensus without a leader. And it doesn't work very well if there is no leadership, no authority, no loyalty. Like, institutions don't work well without it. And so if you're going to burn down all institutions and create something else, you know, it's not filling the gap very easily. Well said, both of you.
Well, can we get to like just a few more superficial kind of things? We've done a lot of the deep religious discussion, but just the production values on these Star Wars shows are just great. I'm loving this era of big budget TV for however long the bubble lasts. And now that we've got the writer's strike, we probably won't get any more for a while. So that's scary. But I started to feel a little bit of the drag of Grogu in this one. Like, the first two seasons, he was adorable. And then I was like, okay, there's only so much acting we can do with a little Muppet. Like, he doesn't have a ton of expression. And especially it showed to me in the episode of The Foundling where they try to give him this flashback to Order 66 and the destruction of the Jedi Temple. And we go to these close-up shots of him remembering, and I'm not getting a lot of emotion off of this puppet. So I don't know if anyone else has anything artistically they wanted to discuss about the show.
There was a couple of subtleties that I really appreciated. And if you didn't watch Clone Wars and Rebels, you may not have gotten them. But when Din Djarin pulls out the lightsaber to fight those three cavemen, four-eyed monster-y things, the actor in the suit, like, lunges like it's heavy, like the blade is heavy. It's a lightsaber, right? It's a blade of light. But in Rebels, when Kanan Jarrus is training Sabine, she's like, why is this so heavy? It's getting heavier. And he teaches her, it's because you're fighting the blade. That darksaber is special. It almost has an essence of its own. And if you're not in tune with it, it will fight you because you're fighting it. You have to be one with the blade. Mm-hmm. And when Bo-Katan picks it up later in that same episode, she's held it before. She knows what to do with it. She's been trained in both Jedi and anti-Jedi, and she got it, right? But obviously that actor wasn't holding the darksaber, but when he lunged as if it was heavy, I was like, oh, that's good. That's really good.
Wow, I did not catch that. That's cool.
Now I got to go back and watch that.
Yeah, he did that and the Purgle. When they're going through light speed and hyperspace, and Grogu sees the Purgle, that's also from Rebels, and tying again in Mandalorian, Ahsoka, the Rebels series, tying it all in. The Purgle is a big sign. I like that.
I liked the dogfight in episode 2 or 3 when they've come back and the Imperials show up, and that was just fantastic. That was so much more fun. And it's not George Lucas's fault, right? Like episode 4 in 1977, that was an amazing and fun dogfight to watch happen. But Top Gun Maverick, which had a better Death Star trench run than the original Death Star trench run, and these two Mandalorians and this series of Imperial TIE fighters trying to get them, it was just so fun. This is what George Lucas would have done in 1977 if they had the technology and the ability to do. And that is actually the one area where I am okay with the 1997 redo, is the dogfight over the first Death Star is improved. None of the other changes I really thought made it substantially better, but the dogfight over the first Death Star, he was able to add things to it that he wasn't able to do 20 or 30 years earlier that made it better.
You don't approve of the George Lucas-inspired translation? Oh. So we'll start our rating segment now. We give each thing we watch 3 ratings. The first one is content. Any questionable content people feel uncomfortable with, we rate it on a scale of celestial, telestial, terrestrial, outer darkness. I feel like there's not a lot of questionable content, like you said, Jacob, in this one. The action can be a little intense. My 7-year-old wandered in while I was watching some of the later episodes. And she's like, oh, this is scary. I don't like it. Or when they're talking about the purging of Mandalore, this is sad. It's intense. So it's intense, but I don't think there's anything particularly objectionable. It's very clean violence, if you will.
That's probably fair. Just because clean violence feels like a bit of an oxymoron.
But there's no blood. There's no blood and gore is what I mean by that.
Yeah, no, I understand. If you're going to have action, and you are, because this is the world, this is the entertainment that we consume now as people in general, and always have and probably always will, this is pretty good stuff. A scene maybe to watch for is where the poor Mandalorian kid gets kidnapped by that whole flying creature, and just the terror of having the child be the person they're trying to rescue, that can be pretty intense.
Definitely a trigger warning on that one.
Yeah, just something if you're going to watch this with your kids, just be aware of that episode. But yeah, I think a good question for this rating of ours is, would you watch this with your grandma? And I think if your grandma was fine watching a show like The Mandalorian, you could absolutely watch this one with her. Yeah, yeah. It's more of a, does your grandma have this taste? But there's nothing objectionable in it.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. Okay, we'll move on from there to a rating for artistic merit, 1 to 5 popcorn balls. Anyone have thoughts on where you'd put this one?
Is 1 popcorn ball better than...
No, 5 is better. More popcorn is better. Jacob is giving us the 5.
Yeah, I would say all of season 3, with the exception of, you're right, the puppet Grogu is a 4, right? I'd give it a 4 because of the exception of the puppet. But the fact that they tie so much into it, Grogu stopping the fire at the end, right? Last episode, and he stops the fire, which is a callback to Kanan Jarrus in Rebels. Again, Dave Filoni. Yeah, I definitely give this a 4.
I did forget to mention about Grogu. I did like in the last two episodes where he got the robot. I think that redeemed the Grogu in my mind because my kids and I were just dying over the no, 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 no. I was like, it sounds like you guys. And I actually used that on my daughter when she came in to beg for something. I was like, no, 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 no.
I'd give it a 5 because remember, I'm watching the Andy Griffith Show when I'm not watching The Mandalorian.
Big difference.
I think I'm going to give this one 4 just because there are a few things that I find a little inconsistent. To use my Dungeons & Dragons vocabulary, it does a really good job of having individual adventures, but sometimes the overarching plot seems a little... I'm not sure where they're going with this. The fact that they've now destroyed the Darksaber, and that now he's just, oh, I'm gonna... We've had all this world-changing Mandalore's back stuff, but I'm just gonna go sit on my homestead out on that original planet that I helped redeem back in season 1. Seems to be a little inconsistent with the writing. I am a big fan of TV shows that have a Bible and that are going in a particular direction or that have a plan. And it seems like this one doesn't. So it's doing a great job, but there are a couple of cracks in the writing because it doesn't seem like they have a specific direction, a place where they know they want to end up. And so that's why I knock overall down to 4, but this season probably was the best of all of them. So maybe this season a 5, overall The Mandalorian is a 4.
Another thing that bothered me a little bit artistically is the plot does move rather fast. Like, all the Mandalorians show up on Nevarro, and then they're like, okay, let's go retake Mandalore. So that was a short colonization period. Like, we'll camp for one night, and then we're taken off to go retake our planet. So because of the time constraints of an 8-episode show, some things were like, okay, that could have been like a 3-episode arc, and we're going to smash it into 1 because we got to move on. So there was a little bit of that bothered me. And I don't know how we didn't mention this during the episode. The Mandalorian covert is in Lake Powell. That is, the backgrounds are all from Utah. So yet again, proving that Utah is an alien planet, as we all know. So I'm going to give it 4 myself as well. It's not perfect by any means, and there are some things that I would personally change, but it's great television. And our final rating is for Gospel Connections, again, on a scale of 1 to 5 apricots. I think this is a 5 for me. This is an explicitly religious speculative fiction show. My genre, my wheelhouse. I love it. I could talk about it all day. I got to rewatch it with my kids so we can do some discussion about redemption.
Yeah, it's absolutely a 5. Whether they meant to or not, it's absolutely a 5. Yeah.
If they're writing Exodus scripture
on a little tablet that no one's going to read,
it's kind of hard to make the argument that they weren't deliberately doing this. Clearly,
right.
I'm going to give it 5-2. I'm sorry we lost Jacob. He had to take off because we ran long in recording, but I would have loved to have heard his thoughts on this as well, particularly. But especially for season 3, morally edifying messages and gospel connections. Sometimes I say I don't want to give it 5 unless it's like really explicitly Jesus Christ centric, but I'm going to throw that one out because in reviewing all of this again, I was just struck by how religious this season was, and that is fantastic. So yeah, 5 apricots for me as well.
Awesome. And you can follow my writing and book reviews on lizbusby.com. Carl, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at Carl Cranny if anybody wants to reach out and say hi.
And Jared, where can people find you on the internet?
So jaredusselman.com, quickflights.com, which is my flying club in Salt Lake City, Utah, for any aviators that are watching this. You can also find me on Twitter at @flyutah or on Instagram @fly_Utah.
And I know we can find Jacob's writing all over various LDS outlets, Deseret News, Public Square Magazine. He's out there. He's written a great article on season 3 of The Mandalorian. So if you need more Mandalorian from an LDS perspective, go and check that article out, which we'll have linked in the show notes. And we thank you all for joining us this week. If you enjoyed this episode, we ask that you share this podcast with a friend who enjoys good movies and good conversation, and you can subscribe on the platform of your choice. And we'd love to hear your thoughts and feedback on this episode. What did you think of The Mandalorian religious-wise or Star Wars-wise? What did you get out of it? Send us an email or contact us on social media or through our website. It makes our day as podcast hosts to hear that you're enjoying our conversations and getting things out of your media that you wouldn't have otherwise. Carl, can you tell us what we'll be discussing in our next episode?
Sure. So next time we'll be discussing Les Mis, specifically the 2012 version, which is a movie version of course, the Broadway play, starring Hugh Jackman and Anne Hathaway, the whole conversation about the French Revolution and justice and mercy and all these great themes that Les Mis has been helping us contemplate and understand now for hundreds of years. So we're looking to do the 2012 movie version and be ready for that conversation in 2 weeks.
It's kind of our faux 4th of July wrong revolution, but that'll be an interesting conversation. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. We'll see you next time.